Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we have open phone lines for you if you want to call in and ask questions on the program. We'd love to have you do that. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or anything about your own spiritual journey, or if you have a different viewpoint from the host, we'd like to balance comment. We have some open lines here at this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, we had a caller yesterday who had been calling off and on to ask when we will have the newest Zechariah lectures up on the website, and I just want to announce they are up there now. They weren't yesterday. They have been added. I taught Zechariah verse by verse last summer, about just a few months ago, actually. And one of the reasons I did is because our older set of Zechariah verse-by-verse lectures were very old. They were over 15 years old or so, and they ended somewhat abruptly. I did not give adequate time, because I ran out of time, to the treatment of the most important chapter, perhaps, in the book, at least the most difficult and controversial chapter in the book, is Zechariah 14. And in this series, I actually gave two full lectures to that one chapter. But if you're interested in Zechariah 14, if you don't have a clue what Zechariah is about in Zechariah 14, then this announcement won't intrigue you. But anyone who's a student of Bible prophecy will be particularly aware of the importance of Zechariah 14. And the entire new set of lectures for Zechariah are now posted. What that means is the MP3 files are there. You can listen to them for free. We have actually verse-by-verse teaching through the whole Bible by yours truly, as well as on many hundreds of topical subjects. There's teachings on there, and they're all free. You just go to thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com, and you click either the tab for verse-by-verse teaching or for topical teaching, and select what you want to listen to, and click on it, and it'll play for you. You can download it onto your device as well, your iPhone or your iPad or iPod or whatever. Okay, so that's just to let you know. They are currently, the new Zechariah lectures are currently loaded up on the website. And there's some other new lectures coming up today, likewise. In fact, many of you may know I have been reteaching the series, What Are We to Make of Israel? I had an older series posted up there from years and years and years ago. Only four lectures. This one's bigger. This is eight lectures so far. It'll be 10 before we're done, but we're getting those loaded up too. So if you're interested in Israel, especially a non-dispensational approach to the subject of what are we to make of Israel, those lectures are up there also, or will be very soon, probably today. So those are some new items. And of course, they're free. Everything at the website is free at thenarrowpath.com. Okay, our first caller today is Eric, calling from Sacramento, California. Eric, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. My question today is about remarrying. My current wife and I have been saved for 3.5 years, and we got married 2.5 years ago. So we're 2.5 years happily married in the Lord, and we were praising God. We teach Sunday school and really enjoying being saved. We are witnessing and things like that. When actually a street preacher that we ran into, we got to know a little bit, just in conversation, I mentioned that I had been previously married. And he raised an eyebrow at me and said, "Is she dead, your first wife?" And I said, "No." And I said to his, what he was saying, I said, "I wasn't, but I wasn't saved then. And she divorced me." And just to let you know a little bit more about it, my first wife, we were married some, it was like 20 years ago. We got married. Didn't get married in the Lord, total heathens, had two children, first one before we got married. A couple years into the relationship, we broke up, both had extramarital affairs, got back together. 10 years later, she had a lesbian affair on me. And then a couple years later, we completely split up, me going my way and having out-of-wedlock sex with females, and she having a relationship with some guy. And then after all that, that's when she filed the papers for divorce on me. I didn't want to get a divorce, believe it or not, after all that. Something in me didn't want to get divorced, and I fought it for a while, and but she kept hounding me with the paperwork. I signed the papers, and was divorced. And then about five years later, a girlfriend and I that I had got saved together. And then a year later, after she went to a Christian women's home for a year, and we separated for a year, and I remained celibate in my new Christian walk. We got back together after that year of separation, firm identity in the Lord, remarried. She and I got married.
You're
and then
secret,
that would
yeah.
be my remarry right there.
Right. Now, she had never been married before?
She had never been married before.
Okay, so this preacher told you that you can't remarry unless your ex-wife is dead. His view is held by some. It was actually a view held in the early church. The early church took a really hard view against divorce and remarriage. However, the early church wasn't right about everything. And as I read the scriptures, Jesus seems to say that divorce and remarriage is forbidden unless the previous marriage has been broken by what Jesus called fornication. And fornication can refer to any kind of sexual sin. There seems to have been plenty of sexual sin in your previous marriage, both on your part and hers. The difference is you've repented, and she apparently has not. And she divorced you. It wasn't your idea to divorce her. It sounds to me like you've been honorable in this, especially in that you and your girlfriend split up for a year after you got saved and then got back together. It sounds like it's all very honorable. Now, you'll always find in your Christian life there will be people who will think that you have no right to be remarried. And that's just the way it is. There's a lot of people who have different views on this. They are not in the majority. Not that that would make a difference, because often the truth may lie on the minority side. But the truth of the matter is you're not going to very often be running into people who think that you're in sin simply because you're remarried. But you will run into them from time to time. And just know that their view is one view that's out there. I don't think it's the most scriptural view. I believe that Jesus allowed for divorce. He didn't tell us to get a divorce or anything like that, but he seemed to give an exception to his general statement was that if you divorce your spouse and remarry, you're committing adultery. But he said, except if it's for the cause of fornication. In other words, unless fornication was present in dissolving your old marriage, and it certainly was. So I would say that although this man has his convictions about it, not only is he in probably the minority among Christians, but I don't think he has really the scripture on his side. I know what scriptures he uses. In fact, it may interest you to read the articles I've written on this subject at the website, thenarrowpath.com. You click on the tab that says topical articles, I've written some magazine articles on this subject, and it's a very thorough thing. It was three articles, and they're all put together as one file at our website. So if you go to topical articles and look up divorce and remarriage, it will cover the entire gamut of biblical considerations, including all the verses that your friend, the street preacher, would have used to make his point. I believe that once you exegete them, I think he's getting the wrong message out of them. So I think that you don't have to worry about the legitimacy of your remarriage in this case.
Well, I sure appreciate that, Steve. One of the things that just to make sure that it's going to be in your art and on your website teaching, One thing that I had read that he had emailed me was about the word, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, porneos, which means fornication.
Pornea, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pornea. And that one of the things that in this article that he had sent me, or this study, it's saying in it, it said that porneo only referred to the betrothal and only referred to being a harlot, actually for money or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. He's giving the party line of his viewpoint.
And yeah, okay.
I deal with that in my articles. I certainly do.
Good.
Yeah, porneia is a very important word. And anyone who says that porneia only refers to the betrothal period simply doesn't know a thing about the Greek words that were used. Greek porneia is used to refer to any kind of sexual immorality, including incest, as in the case of 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul said that the church of Corinth was tolerating porneia in a man living with his father's wife. In the book of Jude, the homosexual behavior of the city of Sodom is referred to as porneia. It says that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah gave themselves over to porneia, seeking after strange flesh. Homosexual sex, incest, bestiality, extramarital sex, pedophilia, adultery, all of these are sexual sins, and all of them are under the cover term of porneia in the Greek language.
Right, yeah, more of a cover term, not so much a specific.
Right.
When Jesus sees that. Okay, just one more thing, Steve. This guy that pointed this out, he's a street preacher. Man, I just want to tell you, he has been railing on me about this. He's like a terrorist, because he's had a similar issue, some kind of thing in his life, and he's seeing me doing. See, he gave up his an opportunity to remarry after he said he studied the scriptures, and he gave it up. So now he's living a life of celibacy because of this. And I'm just telling you, this guy has been railing on us so fiercely.
Well, are you seeing him regularly? How is it that you have regular contact with him?
Well, we were seeing him on the street. We'd go out preaching, and we would be witnessing. He'd be more out preaching, and we started kind of hanging out with him a little bit. And then this came up, and now we realize what a fanatic he is. I just wanted to...
Well, let me just say this. First of all, people who preach on streets do not have my respect as much as they once did. When I was younger, when I was a teenager, I used to think street preachers were really courageous, really admirable, and I really knew that I wish I had the guts to do what they did, because they'd stand out in the street, they'd be loud, they'd be shouting the gospel out, they'd be harsh with people, and people would be harsh back with them, hurling insults at them, throwing things at them. I always thought, wow, these guys are really the bold Christians, you know. Wish I could be like them. And yet, the truth of the matter is there's no example of this kind of behavior in the New Testament. Jesus didn't do this, and the apostles didn't do this. Lots of times street preachers think that they're being like Jesus, preaching in the open air. But Jesus and the apostles, whenever they spoke in the open air, it was when the crowds gathered to hear them, usually because a healing was done or something like that, some miracle was done, and people came out of curiosity. And because the people were there, Jesus or Paul or Peter would preach to them. But in general, the New Testament writers didn't go out into places where people didn't want to hear them and just start shouting and invading their space and making them resent them. We don't find that. In fact, Isaiah 42 is about Jesus, and it's quoted in Matthew 12. It says about him, he will not cry out or lift up his voice in the streets. It says, a bruised reed he will not break, a smoking flax he will not quench. It actually says that he won't lift up his voice in the streets and cry out. He'd be more gentle than that.
Yeah, and the street preacher, he actually uses that as a verse supporting what he's doing.
That's weird, because it says that Jesus wouldn't do that. And in Matthew 12, it quotes it from Isaiah 42 and mentions that that's not how Jesus behaved. Now, I want to say this, that people who do go out and scream at people in the streets, I think they make more enemies of Christianity than converts. in most cases. And they don't mind because they figure that it's the offense of the cross and they're just being faithful. But they may find out when they face Jesus Christ that it wasn't the offense of the cross that drove people off. It was the offense of their personality and of their unkindness and ungentleness. Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 2, the servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but must be gentle toward all men and meek, and in meekness, correcting those who are in opposition. There's a certain demeanor of Christ and of the apostles that is lacking in many of these street preachers. Now, when this guy's, if he's railing on you, see, good on him for remaining celibate. You know, if he was divorced against his will, and if he believes that a Christian who's divorced should never remarry, and he's living by his convictions and staying celibate, well, more power to him. I think people should live by their convictions, and he's got those convictions. I commend him for living by them. But people who put themselves under a hard yoke like that sometimes resent others who aren't living under that yoke, who they think should be. And this is what legalism does. This is a spirit of legalism, that I'm making a sacrifice that is hard to make, so all these other people who are in my condition should be making that sacrifice too. And if not, I'm going to resent them, and I'm going to be angry at them, and I'm going to make them miserable until they make the same sacrifice I'm making. It's clear that people like that are not happily making a sacrifice. They're making a sacrifice for legalistic reasons, and they apparently don't have the grace for it. Apparently, they're not doing what God wants them to do because they don't have grace in it, and it makes them legalistic, makes them judgmental and critical of others, and that's what you're seeing in him. I would just say, I'd say there's better people for you to hang around probably.
Right.
Now there are people listening to my voice. There are people listening to this program right now who probably who have remarried when they shouldn't have. But from the story you told me, you're not one of them.
Thank you.
All right, Eric. Thanks for your call.
It means a lot. It means a lot. My wife's listening too. So we really appreciate you, Steve, and God bless you.
All right. Well, God bless you too. I'm glad to talk to you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye now.
Okay, our next caller is Jim from Tacoma, Washington. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, a comment on your last caller as far as street preachers and stuff. In Acts 20:20, it speaks about Paul not holding anything back, but publicly and from house to house. So whatever that means.
Well, he's talking to the elders. He's talking to the elders of Ephesus, and he's talking about his ministry among them, which was in the past. He was reminding them of how he had ministered publicly and house to house. Yeah, I mean, I'm 100% for public ministry. I'm a public minister. I'm on the radio, right? But but see, I'm not going into anyone's space. If they're listening to me, they tuned in, and they can tune out as soon as they want to. But we never find Jesus or Paul going into some public place and just starting to cause a disturbance and say, and as people would hate him then, saying, well, that's just the offense of the cross. I'm just being a martyr by enduring all this hostility. That's not what Paul did. Now, Paul did speak in the open air or wherever people wanted him to. And he would go into the streets of Athens and contend with people. Apparently, he'd meet with people who had a different opinion. They'd get in a conversation, and he'd make, you know, his case for Christianity. If people want to have a conversation, if people want to argue, or if people come out of curiosity because they saw a healing, or that was usually how it was in Jesus' case. There was a miracle, a healing or something, so the crowds gathered, and so he preached to them. But you see, if the crowds gathered on their own, or they started the conversation, then I'm all for publicly speaking to them. And the more people around who can hear, the better, as long as you're not being rude. It's just that in a case like that, it's their opinion that they were the ones who decided to hear from you because they asked you or they stopped or they were curious or whatever. But to just go out into a street where people are going and minding their own business and start shouting so that they want to hold their ears when they walk by or they go across the street to avoid you, this is not what Jesus did or the apostles.
Right.
But it's very common for street preachers now. Yeah.
Hey, my initial question, though, was in the book of Ephesians, it speaks about anger, not letting the sun go down on your anger, and then it concludes about not giving the devil a foothold, keyword foothold.
Yes.
And then 2 Corinthians 10, fourth verse or something, it speaks about we have divine extremely powerful weapons for the pulling down or demolishing of, and the key word is, strongholds.
Strongholds.
Do you find a distinction between a foothold and a stronghold and what the difference might be?
I don't think the words are the same. A stronghold is usually a fortress, usually a walled city or a walled castle or something like that. Something, a stronghold was someplace where people would flee to when an invader was coming. This was very, like Jerusalem was a stronghold, had big walls and things. And so the people around Jerusalem who were farmers, and they couldn't have their farmland inside the walls. They'd just be too expensive to build walls around all the farm acreage. So people would live outside the walls. But when invaders would come, they would flee to the stronghold, that is to the walled city, and they'd close it up and it'd be a secure place, at least for a while, until the enemies got over the walls or broke them down or something, if they could. But a stronghold is a place of safety, usually a fortress or a walled city or castle or something like that. That's a stronghold. And when Paul says that our weapons tear down strongholds, what he's saying is that as we are aggressively going out to preach the gospel to the world, and the enemy tries to stop us, he tries to secure his slaves against. Okay, I'm back. I don't know where I went. And I don't know how long I was gone. It's like I've had amnesia. But it's actually what it is, is I was talking to our previous caller, and apparently the audio cut out, and I didn't know it. So I finished talking to him, but then he wasn't there. Okay, hopefully I'm back. Kevin, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, I have no idea what our problems are. I've reconnected a couple times, and hopefully we won't cut out again since we have no idea what's making it happen. All right, well, go ahead. I'm sorry for the problems.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you right now, yeah.
Okay, great. You know, you were talking to the brother about the difference between the stronghold and the, a foothold and a stronghold.
Uh-huh.
And you got cut out right then. So I don't think your listeners heard the answer there.
Okay,
I got cut off in the middle of it.
I don't know what happened. Okay, well, as I was saying to our previous caller, because he asked about this, what's the difference between a stronghold and a foothold? In Ephesians 4, it says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, neither give a foothold to the devil or a place to the devil. And in 2 Corinthians 10, it says that we have mighty weapons through God to pull down strongholds. I was just saying that he asked if those are the same thing, and they're not. No, a stronghold is a defensive place. It's a fortress. It's like a castle or a walled city that people run into when there's an invasion, or where people may be held as prisoners against those who wish to rescue them. And it's a stronghold is simply an impregnable place, or one that is intended to be impregnable. Paul said that our weapons are mighty through God to be able to pull down those strongholds. So Satan's strongholds, where he's keeping his prisoners, are not entirely impregnable because of the kind of weapons we have. And through preaching the gospel, through prayer, through godly living, these are the weapons of our warfare. And we are able to tear down those strongholds and to deliver captives. A foothold is simply a place of advantage, an advance against maybe an enemy or against a goal. Getting a foothold, it means you've gained some forward advance and you've secured your position. And it's the same kind of thing that Paul is concerned about in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 in verse 10, when he says that we need to forgive the brother lest the enemy should get an advantage over us, lest Satan should get an advantage over us. And he says, for we're not ignorant of his devices. So a foothold is an advantage, a place of advantage. And when Paul says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath in Ephesians 4, neither give place to the devil, it means don't give the devil an advantage. I believe what he's saying is that Christians, because of the resources God has given us, the Holy Spirit living in us, the armor of God, the weapons of warfare that he's given us, because of these things, the devil can't simply gain advantage over us unless he can fool us into giving him place. And one way that we give place to him or give advantage to him is by being unforgiving and letting the sun go down on our wrath. So that's the short form of what I said before. I didn't realize I was off the air when I was saying most of that.
Okay, great. That helps out tremendously.
I have
a quick question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My question is regarding Jeremiah 37.
Okay.
And the question, and the question being, how is it that the children of Israel experience Jacob's trouble, and the verse also says that Jacob is saved. In other words, he experiences the trouble, and he's saved out of it. So if,
okay.
if the remnant left before the destruction in AD 70, how is it that the remnant were experiencing the distress when they left before?
Well, I personally think this Jacob's trouble that is referred to here is not AD 70, but is 586 BC. I could be wrong because AD 70 was so similar in detail to 586 BC, but Jeremiah is living at a time where Judah is and Jerusalem are facing invasion from the Babylonian armies, which eventually captured them and did mean awful, cruel things to them and took them into captivity. And I believe that is the time of Jacob's trouble that Jeremiah has in mind here, because that was imminent. It was coming upon them. But that Jacob would be saved out of it, I believe simply means that this time of trouble would be temporary, because God would rescue his people out of Babylon eventually. It's not the end of Israel. They're not going to become extinct. And by the way, Edom and Moab and some of these other surrounding nations around Israel also were taken captive by Babylon around the same time, but they never recovered. They never came back. But God did bring Judah back. He did reestablish Jerusalem and the Jewish state. So God saved Jacob out of that situation. Just a couple chapters earlier, actually five chapters earlier, I guess, in chapter 25, Jeremiah had spoken about how the captivity, God was going to take them into captivity for 70 years. And then after that 70 years, he's going to let them, you know, he's going to bring them back and save them. So this is what he had in mind. See, it's in chapter 25:11 says, "This whole land shall be desolate and astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. That, I think, is the time of Jacob's trouble. But the next verse says, "Then it will come to pass when 70 years have completed that I'll punish the king of Babylon and that nation and the land of the Chaldeans for their iniquity, says the Lord, and I will make it perpetual desolations. So I will bring on that land all my words which I've pronounced against them." And so this is his rescuing of Israel, or of Jacob, out of the time of his trouble. 70 years would be the time of trouble, I think.
Interesting. Okay, I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot, brother.
All right, Kevin. Thanks for your call. I appreciate your question. Bye now. By the way, if you're a dispensationalist listening, and you may be tearing your hair because you say, Steve, don't you know that the time of Jacob's trouble is the Great Tribulation period, which is still future. In fact, I don't know that. The fact is that the time of Jacob's trouble is a phrase that's used only one place in the Bible, and it's in Jeremiah 30 and verse 7 in a context where he's talking about the Babylonian invasion. So I guess I'd have to say to those of you who think the time of Jacob's trouble is a reference to future tribulation, the burden of proof is on you heavy to prove that point, because it's only used once. The phrase is only found one time, and it's in the context of the Babylonian invasion, not the end times. Okay, let's talk next to David from Portland, Oregon. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. My question is about the chosen people. I mean, who are the chosen people now? It's not the Jews. So I'm kind of wondering, is it the Christian
people? Well, yeah. The Bible uses the word chosen in the Old Testament to refer to the Jews, and in the New Testament it refers to Christians. It's the word we often encounter it in the English translations, in the English word elect. The word elect is the same word as chosen. It's just a different English word for the same idea. So in the Old Testament, Israel was God's elect, God's chosen people. In the New Testament, Christ is God's elect, and those who are Christians are in him, and therefore elect in him. We share in his elect status, or his chosen status. Now, Israel was chosen, but many people don't have any idea what it means to say someone's chosen. What did God choose them for? A lot of times people assume that the elect or the chosen necessarily refers to personal salvation, And therefore, they make the false assumption that being a part of Israel in the Old Testament made you one of the saved people. That wasn't necessarily true. There were a lot of people who were part of Israel that weren't saved, like Judas Iscariot, like Caiaphas. I mean, there were plenty of people in the Old Testament and New who were Jewish but were not saved. But the nation of Israel was chosen to fulfill the promise that God made to Abraham. And what was that promise? That through his seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Now, that seed is Christ, according to Galatians 3:16. The seed of Abraham that blesses all the nations is Christ himself. So what Israel was chosen for was to bring Messiah into the world, to bring Christ through the line of the Jews. Jesus said salvation is of the Jews. And what he meant is the Messiah, the Savior, comes through the Jewish line. So Israel was chosen for the purpose of bringing Messiah into the world through whom all the nations would be blessed and therefore fulfilling the Abrahamic promise. Now, they did. I mean, Jesus did come into the world through the Jewish race. And therefore, if they're going to be chosen again for a different mission, well, then we'd have to hear about it. The first mission they were chosen for is fulfilled. When Christ was born, they fulfilled their mission. There's no evidence that God chose them for a second mission after that. He chose instead those who are in Christ to carry the gospel to the nations. And so the Bible always refers to the Christians in the New Testament. We're the elect. We're the chosen. So God chose Israel for one thing, and they carried out their mission almost in spite of themselves. Only the remnant managed it because most of the Jews resisted it. Most of the Jews rejected the prophets, killed the prophets, and even wanted to kill Jesus. That's not exactly being willing servants on a mission. But nonetheless, in spite of their disobedience, there was a remnant, a faithful remnant in Israel, through whom Jesus came. Mary and Joseph were part of that remnant. And the disciples who followed Jesus were part of that remnant. And they became the remnant through whom God now is spreading the gospel to the whole world and therefore blessing the nations through the seed of Abraham, which is Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, let's say, for example, if you read in the Bible that God says, those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse, sort of like that. So, like, anybody that's kind of against Christ, they're not going, they're not going to be under the blessing. They're going to be in bad straits with God.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, Paul actually said in 1 Corinthians 16:22, Paul said, if anyone does not love our Lord Jesus Christ, let him be accursed.
Right.
So, I mean, the curse is on those who reject Christ.
Right.
Now, in the Old Testament, when God was still using Israel, anyone who had cursed them would be cursed. God told Abraham, whoever curses you, I'll curse. Whoever blesses you, I'll bless. And Balaam in the book of Numbers made the same statement that whoever curses Israel will be cursed. Whoever blesses them will be blessed. Well, there's a reason for that. They were God's agents. They were God's, missionaries. They were the ones that God chose to carry out his mission until the Messiah would come. But once the Messiah came, that was their mission. Their mission was to bring the Messiah. So he came and they were retired. They were decommissioned. And now they were given the chance. They were given the chance to be recommissioned. They could follow the Messiah and become part of his body because it's his body now that's the elect. It's his body that was chosen now. And they're the ones that he's using to bring the gospel to the nations. He's not using the Jewish race to bring the gospel to the nations, although there are Jewish people who did make the transition. There are Jewish people who, once Christ came and the need for the nation to bring Christ into the world was no longer. But God wasn't done with the world. He commissioned his disciples and to carry the gospel so that, Israel was commissioned by God to bring the Messiah into the world. They were decommissioned. They were decommissioned when their mission was accomplished and Jesus came. But then there's a new commission, a great commission, which anyone can be part of. And that's Jews or Gentiles can be part of that. Originally, it was mainly Jews who were because all the early disciples of Jesus were Jewish.
Right. Okay.
So they got
recommissioned.
All right. Thanks for your call, David. Good talking to you.
Bye.
Bye now. All right. Jim from Everett, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got a question. I read the Left Behind series and was entertained by it. And my question runs in Ezekiel 39. There's a statement about Gog and Magog getting waylaid in the mountains north of Israel. Has that happened?
Well, many people think it has, and many people think it is not. The Left Behind series reflects the dispensational approach to Bible prophecy, which places most of these kinds of events in the future. And so the Left Behind series is going to take the position that Gog is modern-day Russia, and that, you know, modern-day Russia is going to be destroyed in an abortive attempt to invade Israel, and that that's going to happen in the future. That's the dispensational view. Now, I don't hold the dispensational view. I hold the view which is more the historic Christian view. And on that view, Gog and Magog in the battle there in Ezekiel 38 and 39 represent some invaders that came against Israel after Judah came back from the Babylonian exile. That's the context in Ezekiel. You have in Ezekiel 37, God promising to bring Judah and the Jews back to reestablish them in Judah, which he did in 539 B.C., and then after that, he said he'd bring Gog down to attack them, but he'd wipe out Gog and Magog. Now, there's no country known as Gog, and there's no ruler known as Gog. So this is apparently a symbolic name, and who it refers to has been much disputed. Like I said, dispensationalists believe it refers to modern-day Russia. Older commentaries before dispensationalism believed that it referred to some attack that came on Israel after they returned from the Babylonian exile. Now, this could be Antiochus Epiphanes, who came against them in 168 B.C. It could be, as some believe, it's a reference to Haman and the plot made by the Persian government against all the Jews, which was thwarted by Esther and Mordecai. There's a number of theories about, you know, who it was that was this great enemy that came against Israel but was defeated so providentially. And I don't know that I could really say who it is. I believe that, for example, some of the older commentators like Adam Clark believed it was Antiochus Epiphanes. And there's some other commentators I've read who believe it's Haman and the Persian attempt to exterminate the Jews. Of course, they've had plenty of people come against them, but those are two instances where powerful people tried to destroy the Jews, and God, you know, thwarted that attempt. Now, if someone says, "But they didn't come down on horses, and they didn't get fire and brimstone from heaven, didn't come down and consume them, and they didn't spend 7 years burning the weapons and 7 months burying the bodies," so you know, how could that be? Well, Ezekiel 38 and 39 appears to be written in apocalyptic imagery, and therefore to describe these victories in that kind of language would be very typical of how apocalyptic writings were. They would take an ordinary military defeat and describe it as if it was, you know, something that had cosmic interference. When the Jews celebrated their victory, when Deborah in the book of Judges led Israel against Sisera, and he was killed, and they sang a song of victory afterwards. They said the stars in their heavens fought against Sisera in their poetic song. This is, of course, the stars in heavens didn't fight against Sisera, but that's just the way the Jews talked about things like this when they were speaking poetically or apocalyptically. They spoke about ordinary battles which were won in the normal ways in many cases, but used it as if, you know, the heavenly bodies themselves were involved. So this language of fire and brimstone from heaven, you know, consuming their enemies and so forth, I think it's simply reminiscent of the way that Sodom was destroyed, and it's comparing the enemies that were destroyed with Sodom, just like the book of Revelation uses fire and brimstone sometimes as an image for the destruction of God's enemies. It's language from Sodom and Gomorrah that's repeated in newer situations relevant to new evil enemies being destroyed. But I can't tell you whether it's Antiochus or Haman or someone else, but my own view is that it's not about a modern battle with modern Russia. And one reason for my saying so is that if you read the story in Ezekiel 38 and 39, these people come down on horseback. They're wearing armor. They have swords. They have bows and arrows. They have wooden weapons. This is an ancient battle. It's not describing a modern battle. And if someone says, well, you know, bows and arrows and swords, those just are symbols of modern weaponry. Well, if we're going to make those symbols of modern weaponry, why wouldn't we take the fire and brimstone that comes out as symbolic? I mean, how do you decide what to take symbolic and what not? This is describing a battle that would come, it's placed chronologically right after or shortly after the Jews were from Babylon. And so we would look for it in Old Testament history, not in some future scenario.
Okay. Yeah, I thought something was off with that, and so that helps a lot.
Okay. Well, it's a popular thing, very popular for people to take Ezekiel 38 and 39 and say, well, this is a coming battle. Russia's going to invade Israel. And I'm sure with Russia now, you know, firmly planted in Syria, that's pretty close to Israel. So I'm sure that a lot of people are really starting to think, oh, we're going to see this now. Russia's going to invade Israel. And then there's going to be fire and brimstone from heaven and destroy 5/6 of Russia's armies. And they'll burn their weapons for 7 years and so forth. Well, I'll just say this. I doubt it. Because I don't think that's what Ezekiel's talking about. But I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks again.
Okay, Jim. Good talking to you. Thanks for your call. Okay, our next caller is Michael from Live Oak. Hey, it's been a while, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you. I wanted to revisit the topic of reincarnation.
Okay.
By the way, you've been really... I've been trying to call. You've had a lot of callers lately, which is good.
Yeah, we fill the lines up, yeah.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, a woman called, maybe it was longer than that, maybe a month or two ago, a woman called and she was asking you to describe the Christian refutation of, she was asking for the Christian take on reincarnation, and you gave a very traditional refutation. But before I continue, are you aware of Edgar Cayce? Have you heard of him?
Yes, of course, yeah.
And did you know that he was a Christian?
Well, he professed to be a Christian, that's right.
And he evidently had some clairvoyant abilities and could, so it was claimed, see the previous lifetimes of people or know what had occurred in their previous lifetimes. And the body of evidence for that, not just with him, but from other sources, is quite extensive. I don't know if you're familiar with the full range of the records, the case studies, and so on.
Well, no, I don't know the full range of them, but I certainly have heard over the years many reports of people allegedly remembering past lives and things like that.
Right, right. It always made sense to me, even before I started studying the Eastern traditions. I know that it's not part of your view and it's not part of the Christian view, but you have to acknowledge it. It fills in a lot of gaps, you know, in terms of justice and the differences in people, you know.
It does explain some issues of justice, and it is one of the explanations possible. The two worldviews, of course, there's three. One would be an entirely naturalistic worldview that suggests there's no justice at all, that after you die, there's, you know, if you've been unrequited for your good deeds, right, or unrequited for your bad deeds, well, that's just an imbalance that goes on into forever because there's no life after this one. That's a view that both of us reject. But there's two alternatives to the naturalist view. There's one would be the Judeo-Christian or biblical worldview, and the other would be the Eastern worldview, which you embrace. And they both of them make their effort to explain how it is that injustice does not seem to be redressed.
Right.
That many people suffer a great deal innocently and never are repaid for their innocence or never redress their wrongs. And other people, they just do evil all their life and they never seem to suffer for it. So reincarnation is one way to explain how justice will prevail, because the ones who have done more evil than they've been rewarded for will come back and have to suffer for it in the next life and maybe many lives afterwards. And those who have done good and have not been repaid for their good, they can come back in a more privileged condition than before.
Right.
And of course, Christianity has a different answer, and that is that God is paying attention. God is keeping track of all unredressed injustices, and he's going to settle the scores at the day of judgment. So both views have a judgment and a redress. It's just that your view doesn't have a personal God. You don't have a personal God because you're a Buddhist, and as without a personal God, you simply have, you know, forces out there that are somehow committed to settling these scores. But they're not personal forces. And to my mind, it's not at all clear why impersonal force, let's say like a force like electricity, why it would have any interest in making sure that justice is done. Well, whereas Christianity teaches there's actually a God who has an interest in that and actually does, you know, make sure that justice is done.
Generally speaking, and I know time is short, but I'll try and be quick. The way it's understood is it's more like an action of body, of an actual activity or a word or a thought, body, speech, and mind, all of those activities are like seeds, and they carry within, that seed carries within the potential of a particular type of fruition. And it's pretty much, I mean, what the Buddha describes is pretty much along the lines of what one would think. If you, let's say somebody's been very generous, the karmic fruition would be wealth and abundance. If one has...
Yes, so, I understand that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So,
the
fruition is carried within the seed of the activity itself. That's, generally speaking, how it's understood.
And how did that system get set up?
Well, that actually was the Buddha did not actually originate that. That was already in the Vedantic.
No, I don't mean how did the belief system get set up, but how did the actual system, how did the universe come to exist in a way that it made sure that every deed receives its just, recompense in the final analysis, even if you have to go through many hundreds of lifetimes for it to happen? How did that arrangement in the universe begin?
It would be similar to if different types of, say, vegetation or trees. If you plant a lemon tree, you'll get a lemon and not a lemon tree and not an apple tree. So likewise, if you act with a non-virtuous or malicious motivation, that will bear a certain type of fruit.
That doesn't really seem to be so in real life. I mean, we can say, well, since that doesn't happen in real life, we're going to postulate that that happens in another life, which we will have no way to confirm or disconfirm. We can just say, well, that person, you know, he's taken some bad karma with him into the next life. He, you know, I don't want to be him. But we don't know that that's true. But we do know that Jesus came back from the dead, and he told us the truth. And he certainly taught there's going to be a judgment where everyone is going to be judged for every idle word they speak and everything they do, and there will be justice done. I'm sorry we're out of time. The music has simply cut us off, and we'll talk again sometime, Michael. Thanks for calling. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do it from our website, thenarrowpath.com is the website. thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.